is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. As we continue our efforts to engage government executives who are changing the way government does business, we are here in New York City. Local and state governments are under tremendous pressure to do more for its citizens and to do it better. Technology has helped governments to do just that. And nowhere is this more evident than in the delivery of human services. Governments have sought technologies that make such operations more responsive, accessible, transparent, and accountable, while meeting the needs and expectations of its citizens. With us today to discuss his efforts in this area is our very special guest, Richard Seamer, Deputy Commissioner and Chief Information Officer at the New York City Human Resources Administration. Richard, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here, Michael.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Stuart Vinsky. Stuart, welcome.
Thanks.
Rich, would you give us an overview of the mission and scale of the New York City Human Resources Administration?
Sure. HRA, Human Resources Administration, provides, it's one of the largest municipally run social service agencies in the country. We're actually larger than a lot of the states in the scope of what we do. We have to responsibly provision food stamps, cash assistance, Medicaid are our three big programs, but we also have Adult Protective Services. The Office of Child Support Enforcement is another big entity that we deal with. And then we have domestic violence and a couple of other smaller programs. When I say responsibly, I mean we're not only responsible to the citizens of New York who get these services, but I believe that we're also responsible to the taxpayers of New York because they pay for us administering these services. And so I think that that is included in part of our mission.
So how does your office, the Office of Management Information Systems, support such an important strategic mission as HRA's? And what are some of the key mission support function activities you folks provide?
So aside from the basic administrative stuff that MIS does for HRA, we really have two sides to our mission. One is the back office stuff, keeping the lights on, the infrastructure, network, desktops, telephony, all of that stuff. And that stuff is pretty much taken for granted, but it's not easily, especially in the size of an agency like HRA, it's not easily done. But the more visible side and the sexier side, I guess, of the operation is really applications development. We have a large portfolio of applications. We not only do applications for HRA, but we actually partner with a couple of the other human services agencies in the city, like the Administration for Children's Services. We support their child care system. That goes back to a time when HRA and ACS were really just one big agency. So those are mainly the two areas, the applications development and that portfolio, and the infrastructure side.
So what's the size of your staff and operation budget?
I have staff of about 800. That includes both consultant staff, which is much smaller now, and city staff. My expense budget, with including the personnel side of it, is over $100 million. And my capital expenditures varies, but it's between $20 and $30 million a year.
So what about your specific role as Deputy Commissioner and CIO? What are your official responsibilities and what's a day in the life like for you?
Well, my job as the CIO for the Human Resources Administration really is to provide leadership and support to my staff and to make sure that what I am doing is in alignment with what the commissioner or Commissioner Dorr wants for the agency, what the program areas need to do, and really what's laid out by the deputy mayor for all of social services in the city, Deputy Mayor Gibbs. We run a 24/7 shop. We have grown to that big, and we interact with not only internally but externally with providers and other vendors that provide services. So we have to have that interface going all the time. But a typical day, yesterday I was concerned about the heat issue that was here in the city. Much like your life, you think you have plans, and then life happens, right? So I'm in the office, and I start a meeting, and then I get a call that we're having an issue with one of our battery backup. It's all part of our infrastructure for maintaining the integrity of our data center. Anyway, we had a fault there, and we had to switch to generator power. And I'm very fortunate in the infrastructure in the building that I have. I have a very pretty modern building, and our data center is pretty modern, so I have that kind of redundancy. So we switched over to generator power. And then I tried to go back to my work, and I had a couple of meetings, and I had to reach out to a couple of people and deal with a couple of vendors. I'm fortunate that I have good staff, and they were well represented at that meeting, so I didn't have to worry about that piece of it. I have an open door policy, and sometimes that's a detriment, but people come in all the time, and you know, you have to stop, listen to what they want, and then decide whether or not it's something you have to deal with or want to deal with immediately. It's never boring, and I'm fortunate about that, actually. So
given the scale of the of New York City and the scope of programs you work with and all the things that can happen on a day-to-day basis, what are the top three challenges, sort of more strategically, that you face in your position, and what are you doing to address those challenges?
Well, the first one is managing our budget. You know, when I said earlier our expense budget was over $100 million and our CapEx was, you know, between $20 and $30 million, for a lot of people that sounds like a lot of money. But there's no end to the amount of innovation and work that is being asked of us to do. So to that end, and especially because we've been forced to reduce our budgets lately, and that goes back to the being responsible part that I talked about before to the taxpayers, we've had to make some tough decisions, and we've had to balance and decide where can we reduce costs, what ultimately can we do with those savings when we do reduce costs, and how can we more efficiently manage the work that we have to do. So the dollar thing and the budget thing is a big deal. Governance is another big issue. Governance is, to some people, a four-letter word because you're trying to impose some sort of control over people and you're trying to make people responsible. Now, I've been very fortunate, I think, in that, again, I have a good team of people, but the people that I deal with on the program side get it. I've established a relationship with these people, so they're responsive, and I can talk to them about it. But the way we deal with it is we meet regularly with the staff, the program staff. We go through what we're working on. We make sure that the priority lists are what they are supposed to be, you know, and then we make changes because whether it's from the program side or we get mandates, which is another difficult thing. That's how we deal with the governance issue, basically. The third thing is strategic planning. Part of the, I think, challenge of being in the public sector is trying to deal with the cycles, the political cycles, if you will. Now, we've been very fortunate. We have Mayor Bloomberg is a mayor who understands and gets IT. So we feel that kind of support, and that comes straight down through the deputy mayor, and Commissioner Doar is great. Commissioner Doar has actually elevated the position of CIO within HRA to a direct report to him, and I think that that was a smart thing. But it also gives you some sort of empowerment, too. Like I said, I'm fortunate in that I'm not dealing with that, but I see it in other areas. I see it in other programs, and still, it's still sometimes difficult to try and get, especially when you're competing against other agencies in the city, to try and get the Office of Management and Budget to fund ideas that you think will help when they say, everything's okay right now. There's no fires to put out here. There's no, you know, so why do I have to disrupt the status quo? So strategic planning, I think, is another problem.
Rich, I'd like to focus more about yourself, learn a little bit more about you. Would you give us a sense of your career path? When did you begin your career, and how did you get to where you are now?
Well, here's the thing. There's an interesting book, The Outliers. I don't know if you're familiar with it. The essence, what I took away from that book and what I can relate to in my own life is that you have to put in your 10,000 hours of hard work, right? And then you have to be able to seize opportunities that are there for you. Now, when I graduated from college, I went to a city university. When I graduated from college, I decided that I was going to change the world. I majored in social services, right? And I was going to, you know, make everything right and do justice by people and all that kind of stuff. I went to work for a private nonprofit for employment and training of ex-offenders. Long story, but the executive director there decided that he wasn't going to be an example for the ex-offenders that we were trying to support. He was going to take their example. And so he actually wound up embezzling a lot of money. And the city asked me to stay on to close out a lot of the contracts. There was a woman who asked me to have her stay on, a woman, a great woman by the name of Mona Shub. I didn't know it at the time, but Mona, after we were closing down and the program was closing down, Mona had a tie into a big shot at the time in the city. And she said, "And I want you to do me a favor." And the favor was to get me into the city. So I was hired by a guy by the name of Al Giovi. He's a great guy. He was a mentor to me. He was a great example to me of how to run and be a leader and stuff like that. Al gave me opportunity. And so I was running an IT shop, and I had an opportunity to interview for Al's job after he retired. I went and met with then-Commissioner Eggleston, and the first question she asked me was, you know, why does a technocrat, because she saw me as this IT guy, and I think she thought I was a geek or something, but she said, why do you as a technocrat want this job? It's running a program. And I said, excuse me, Commissioner, I'm sorry, but I'm not a technocrat. I'm a manager. And right away she said, you know what, you're not going to have that job. You're going to run my IT shop because you said you're a manager.
It's a wonderful story, Rich. And you know, it leads into the next question I have, because what you've described in this conversation, and particularly with that story, is what are the characteristics of an effective leader? And given the fact that we are in an increasingly interconnected and networked world, does our conception of leadership need to change?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think that the roots of my ability to be a leader really came from my experience within my family. I'm one of 12 children.
Wow.
And I was next to the youngest and the youngest boy, so, you know, I had to learn quickly how to be patient and how to realize that I can't control everything. But I also had to learn how to communicate and understand that it's not all about me, it's about everybody, and how we had to work together really as a family to make a go of things. Given that we're much more connected now and much more networked, I think that the qualities of a leader don't change. I think that you have to be a good communicator, and I think that you have to be able to listen. Technology, I think, allows me to do that on a broader scale. I can shoot somebody an email and still relay an idea and still keep in touch with them and still share something with them. And so not everything has to be face-to-face. So I think that as long as you maintain the idea of being a good communicator and a good listener and being open to suggestions that people have and trying to understand at its core what people are trying to get at when they're trying to relay an idea to you, and you have to check that with, make sure it's not about their ego or make sure it's not about their own accomplishments or something like that, I think you can be a successful leader. So I don't think that that changes. I just think that technology enables you to do that more on a broader scale.
What is the New York City Human Resources Administration's IT strategy? We will ask Richard Seamer, Deputy Commissioner and Chief Information Officer at HRA, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Richard Seamer, Deputy Commissioner and Chief Information Officer at the New York City Human Resources Administration. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Stuart Vinsky. Rich, given the breadth, size, and diversity of services and programs provided by HRA, would you tell us more about your IT strategy managing such a significant portfolio?
I have a very large development staff, and We have a portfolio of over 400 applications. What I am trying to do strategically is to create an environment so that, along the lines of service-oriented architecture, so that redundant processes can be available for the people to use so that we can more efficiently develop applications by using these redundant processes.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier as one of your main challenges, IT governance. And I would like to sort of delve into that because governance is a key to any organization's ability to effectively respond to something and to keep controls and changes as needed. Would you elaborate on your efforts to enhance IT governance within your agency to foster an enterprise view?
When I first took over, one of the biggest things that I realized was that we had no way of being accountable, not only within MIS, but as an agency, in terms of making sure that what we were working on was in alignment with what the commissioner wanted. I contacted some people in some other agencies who had some models. I spoke to both vendors and people in other departments, the Department of Information Technology and Telecommunications, which is the city's central IT office, was of some assistance too. You know, and when I was first got the job, I thought that I was all powerful and I could get, any resources I wanted. And, you know, and then I, you know, I quickly realized that just like in my family, I wasn't a big shot. So I had to scale down my idea. I wanted to implement immediately a project management office. So ultimately, what I did was we are a service organization. And that's my job, to be support and to be of service to the program areas. I established relationships with the service, with the program areas, and I emphasized good customer service, being responsible, telling people when you were going to do something, committing it to a project plan, and saying this is the scope of what we're going to do, this is when I'm going to do it. They always have the option of changing that, but when they did, I let them know it, and I engaged them, and I said, listen, if you're going to tell me this now, and I implemented regular meetings with the senior level staff of the program areas, and I said, this is our portfolio for you. If you want to change this, it's going to affect this, 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 or this. You make the call. I'll do whatever you tell me to do, but you make the call. And that way, there was governance being put over them, but they were responsible for it. And I thought that that was a strategic way to allow them to say, you know, what they thought was important, for them to be aware of what we were doing for them. I had a level of credibility with this program areas. And so they trusted that what I said I could get done, I could deliver.
And it's really a trusted business advisor to the program leaders.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, of course, I meet with Commissioner Doar directly. He has a broader view of things. And so there are times when, he understands the value of something that I don't see from my level.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about green computing. Lots of government agencies are now taking green computing seriously, and both private sector and local agencies are pursuing green solutions. Would you elaborate on your efforts to be good environmental stewards and move toward green computing?
Sure. You know, Mayor Bloomberg implemented a couple of years ago, Planet, I guess they call it. And in his way, he was very forward-thinking about green initiatives. And he's laid out a plan, mostly led by DOIT and DOIT Commissioner Carol Post, wherein he's looking for a data center consolidation. He's looking for us to maximize the resources that we have and at the same time become more green about how we run our operations, whether it has to do with we can reduce electrical. One of the technologies that we've leveraged is virtualization. Virtualization has allowed us to consolidate and reduce the number of servers that we have. We've done some of data center consolidation. When I got into my position, our network wasn't as resilient or reliable or redundant. We're in over 100 sites in the city, but we have 30 or so cash assistance offices and 30 food stamp offices. We had a mini data center at each one of those sites. The network infrastructure wasn't there, and we couldn't afford the chance that the network would go down. We were able to build out our network, but we have a lot of redundancy and a lot of capacity in the space where I am now. We were able to take out all of those data centers, not only made sure that we were being more green in terms of we didn't have to operate these 30 mini data centers, but it made our operation more efficient because we could do more with the equipment that we had back in central office and reduce really the need for the individual maintenance at all those sites.
As a follow-up, could you tell us more about your efforts to move toward a thin client environment? First, what is thin client technology and how does it differ from other types of operating environment? And second, could you elaborate on the benefits of going in this direction and the status of your implementation efforts in this area?
In a traditional architecture, there is a network and you have desktops, and on those desktops, there's software. In thin client technology, it allows you to centralize the provisioning of all those applications and not have the need for the as much infrastructure locally at the end user side or software or operating systems or maintenance on the end user side. So thin client technology actually allows you to streamline the maintenance and reducing that electrical, but also the management of all the patching and the updates that we have to do to programs. We can do it in one place now. We don't have to worry about, okay, I have to send this out to over 18,000 desktops that we have in over 100 sites throughout the city. We've piloted a hardware solution at one of our job centers, and it worked very well. The people actually noticed improved response. You know, we surveyed the staff before and after, and, you know, they gave us kudos on the technology. We were ready to expand that implementation through virtualization of desktop and through technologies like Citrix, where you can web-enable applications. We've been able to provision more of a thin client technology for certain of our applications. A lot of our applications are older and were written with what they call a fat client, which required software on the desktop, if you will, to execute. And through the use of things like Citrix and VMware, we've been able to develop a more thin client approach where we can execute those from the back end. We continue to press on with that. We have some challenge with virtualizing the desktop and all of the applications that we have, but we're attacking them and it's moving in the right direction.
So you've mentioned a couple of times virtualization. And I'd like for our folks out there to understand what is virtualization?
So virtualization is really the ability to maximize the resources available. Virtualization allows you to combine those, shares the server resources among all the applications and gives it to them on an as-needed basis so that we can provision the resources needed when they're needed, at the point that they're needed, and consolidate and make more efficient the use of the servers that we have.
Are you in an implementation phase, or is it pretty much operational now?
Well, thanks to some of the leadership that's been provided by DoIT, and like I said, Carol Post has been very supportive about this. DoIT did a citywide enterprise-wide contract for software virtualization. And so HRA jumped right on it. We had over 1,000 servers, but we've been able to reduce by about 60% of those servers now have been virtualized. And we keep moving on.
For human service agencies, one of the great advantages of technology has been the ability to share data among workers and agencies, et cetera, more easily. But it's also made organizations more vulnerable to unlawful and destructive penetration. Would you elaborate on your efforts to improve IT security, and what are some of the ways your office protects personally identifiable information?
We take very seriously the idea about protecting client information, and this goes way back, before HIPAA was a big thing and stuff like that. There are certain social service law mandates that obviously are imposed upon us, but we try very hard. The first thing we did was come off the public network. Right? We have our own private network within HRA. Within all the sites that we have firewalls put up. Anybody who comes in from the outside actually has to go through two levels of security because everybody goes through DoIT when they come in, and they come through HRA's firewall. whenever we send information out or receive information, it's done through a secure protocol, and it's encrypted on the way in and the way out. You know, we're very confident about that. We use virtual private networks, which allow people who have to come into us just to tunnel in and just be restricted to what they have to get to, and they can't get to other things. So in those ways, we provide security around all the data that we have. But, you know, the funny thing is, I think our biggest threat is internally. And I think that one of the things that I enacted, and much to the chagrin of a lot of people, is that when we put PCs out there, I locked down the CD drives, the flash drives, because it just makes it too easy for people to walk out with information.
How is the City of New York using technology to transform the delivery of human services? We will ask Richard Seamer, Deputy Commissioner and Chief Information Officer at the New York City Human Resources Administration, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept. Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by David Wild, examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing, and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in the States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Richard Seamer, Deputy Commissioner and Chief Information Officer at the New York City Human Resources Administration. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Stuart Vinsky. Rich, in the last segment, you did a wonderful job of really explaining the technical framework that does what human service programs seek to do, and that is help low-income individuals and families become self-sufficient. I'd like to talk to you about how technology itself can enhance service delivery to improve client outcomes while improving responsiveness to those in need.
So that's actually an interesting question. Back with welfare reform in the mid-90s, I guess, really the shift there was to make people more responsible for their own outcomes and to make people more self-sufficient. What we've been able to do, actually the way technology has kind of aided some of that, is by making access to programs and to functions that people have to execute in order to remain in those programs more prolific and more available to people. The onus is now on people to take their own personal responsibility to interact with the agency in the way they need to at the times they need to. And so what does that mean? That means that with our interactive voice response system, people who have to report their attendance for child care can do so well with a phone anytime they need to do it. But it's on them to do it. People who want to explore what services are available and maybe begin an application process can do so through things like the city's portal, Access NYC. People who are looking for health insurance have a way to do that in an interactive way through the health insurance link that the agency has put up. So I think that that's kind of neat, that we've been able to support this idea of self-sufficiency through the use of technology, but with the solutions that we provide, it's also made our operations more efficient. The more work that a person can do or a community-based organization can do prior to the submission of an application, the better quality application we get, and the easier it is, quote-unquote, easier for us to process those applications. So technology has been a big enabler of that.
In the economic environment that we are in right now, do you see technology assisting state and local agencies and providing them with an opportunity to rethink how they actually deliver services and benefits.
Absolutely, Michael. IT has, and the technology that is available to us now, has given us a great opportunity to, like I said, meet people on their level. Before, what would happen was people would have to say, I need this service. And they'd come in as an individual, and the workers knew at the time that, well, they came in my door, they're here for welfare. They're here for cash assistance. But now we can ask more, because of technology, we can make people aware of, before they even come in the door, of all the services that are available to them and how they might apply for any of those services. And we can share information among organizations so that we're more aware and have a better, a more holistic view of what a person's needs are and where they are with any one of the human services programs. You know, we partner with the state in a lot of the same ways because when we share technology and we share solutions, then we're in better alignment to realize the benefits from sharing data and sharing information about how we get things done.
And that really goes into what I want to talk about next, which is NYC Connect. What is that initiative? And more importantly, what are some of the barriers you see to information exchange among New York City HHS agencies?
HHS Connect, or Health and Human Services Connect in New York City, was an idea that started a long time ago. You know, the idea of sharing data among agencies that had siloed systems and stuff like that was not innovative in and of itself. But being able to execute that and being able to put the governance around that so that you could start to realize this vision of sharing data is really what HHS Connect is all about. And, you know, kudos have to go to Deputy Mayor Gibbs and Kamal Barwani, who was the first CIO of HHS Connect, because he put the governance in place, I think, that enabled a lot of this effort to share data. Now, the biggest obstacles to sharing data, really, and one of the things Kamal was smart about in terms of his governance was he included a legal group, a legal committee, because the sharing of data has to be vetted in any number of different ways. The city is local. We're responsible to the state and the social service laws of the state, but some of our information is federally obtained. So we have to make sure that anything that we share in accordance with all of those laws, and even across agencies. The police department has approached us, and in their real-time crime center, they see the value of having information. Now, we have some individual ways that police department get information, but they want it real-time, and they want it right there for the officer on site to be able to deal with and have as much information as possible to make decision. A lot of that information we can't share like that. The great thing about HHS Connect was that the mayor issued an executive order, which was another smart thing that Kamal did and the deputy mayor did in terms of making sure that you had the executive sponsorship there. He issued an executive order that told people, listen, I get that there's, I mean, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but I get that there's barriers to sharing data. Do whatever you can to make sure that within legal constraints that you do as much of that sharing as is possible. And that has helped in a lot of ways. Right now where we are with HHS Connect is HRA was the first supplier of information to the first phase of HHS Connect. So that was the worker portal. So all of HRA and a lot of HRA's data related to cash assistance, food stamps, and Medicaid was shared with appropriately shared with a lot of the other human services agencies, and it made it available to them through the Worker Connect portal. That's been expanded now in phase two. So not only is HRA sharing information, but we're also sharing images through our image repository, and we're getting data from other agencies. That goes a long way in terms of, like I said before, giving an end user, a caseworker who's dealing with the client at a point in time, a lot of information to be able to say, what is the best service or what is the best service plan that can be provided to somebody at any given time.
So HRA is responsible for the administration of public health insurance in New York City. Would you tell us more about your IT efforts to increase access to both public and lower-cost private health insurance? And specifically, what can you tell us about the New York City Health Insurance Link and how it assists HRA in this area?
So New York City HiLink, or Health Insurance Link, was an application that really was the brainchild of Commissioner Dewar and Marjorie Cadigan, who is the Executive Deputy Commissioner for what we call the Office of Citywide Health Insurance Administration. The unique thing about that application is that it's really a combination of what we developed as a web application for people to gain access to, but we invoke a service, a private service that has a lot of information and provides the ability to calculate what a person may be eligible for or inform people about what health, private, or, you know, public health insurance programs may be the best solution for them given what they submit. So it's not only for individuals, it's for small businesses also. So we're very proud of that application. It really is innovative, and I have to give Marjorie a lot of credit because, and Commissioner Dewar, because we were able to negotiate with this outside vendor for this service, which was for fee service, you know, for each time you used its service, and just get kind of like a blanket coverage. And so now all the citizens of New York are benefiting from that solution. So, but that acts, it can act as a doorway to public health insurance, right? We run the Medicaid program. There's over 2.6 million people that we provide that for, and Health Insurance Link can point an individual towards that. We've expanded our outreach with Medicaid by creating an application which we call Edits, which allows for the electronic submission from private providers on behalf of clients for Medicaid benefits. We tell the providers they have their own applications for collecting that information. We just give them the standard for submitting that application for that information and the documents associated with that. And then we, in this way, we allow and we kind of push out the responsibility for collecting all of that data to the people who are engaging these clients either in their neighborhoods or at their point of greatest need if they come into a hospital or something like that. And then they act as a facilitator in the submission of the application. So we get a better quality application, and we are able to still deal with the volume, and technology has played a big part in that.
In an attempt to improve customer services and waiting time, HRA piloted model centers. Would you tell us more about how those centers work and your office's role in making them possible and the benefits you've realized because of them?
The innovative thing about model office is that it kind of models itself on a bank, I would say. When you come in now, you're greeted by the front desk reception. And people have benefit cards, and there's some, you know, information on there, such as identifiable information, a case number or something like that. We can swipe that now through a card reader and then bring up if they have an appointment there. If they have an appointment there, then we can notify the caseworker that this person is here now for this, and then we can manage the traffic through the building so that only the people who need to go up and see their workers can go see their workers. But at the same time, we can take people who are just coming in to drop off something and direct them appropriately. So those people no longer have to go see the caseworker just to drop off a document or something. They can go to another area where we can service them more immediately. So the front desk reception, I think, was a very good idea in being able to manage the traffic. But I think that a latent benefit of it also was how we engage the clients. Here we're engaging the clients as they come in, and we're really treating them more responsibly, I think. And I think clients respond to that. I think that there's an expectation, especially because a lot of the clients that we deal with now, we've reduced significantly our cash assistance, and we've increased Medicaid and food stamps, but those programs are really more supports to lower income people. And so the idea of being able to engage these people in a way and manage their expectations and make them responsible, I think that all fits with the technology. The technology supports that idea.
So model offices represent sort of a transformation of the business model for receiving benefits for accessing HRA services. How did the technology that you brought to bear support model offices, particularly things like Fred and Monique?
So FRED is an acronym for front end or reception, front desk reception. And like I said before, it allows people to come in and allows us to engage that person almost immediately to find out what they're there for and to try and direct them appropriately. Monique, which is really our electronic queuing system for people, you know, it works very much the way it might work in a DMV office, right? You go in, you get a ticket, and you tell the person what you're there for, you get a ticket, and then you're directed appropriately. And then when your ticket is called, you know, you go get serviced. The good thing about Monique is not just how it queues people and directs them, you know, but it's an accountability for us, and it's a management tool for us, because we produce a lot of management reports that say this person was here for this today, and it took them this amount of time to get serviced. That helps tremendously. The managers, the directors of the centers, and the executive directors and the deputy commissioners, because it helps them manage their operation, helps them get information about what's the biggest delay, and then adjust their service delivery appropriately. So the management reporting that comes out of that, I think, is a big deal.
The environment you find yourself in, and a lot of the engagements that happen, the encounters with citizens, may be paper intensive. And the use of imaging technology to digitize paper-based processes has been known to save money and improve operations. I'd be interested to know about your enterprise content management efforts. How have you sought to find and realize these benefits by implementing imaging technology and digitizing a paper-laden process?
So just to try and give you some perspective on this, HRA has a huge imaging document management repository. We have over 50 terabytes of information, and so for the layperson, that translates to over, my notes here tell me, over 1.3 billion pieces of paper, you know, that we have imaged on our repository. The great thing about that, though, is that we are more responsible with regard to our clients. People can come in and we can say, okay, we already have this on file. That reduces the demand on them to reproduce things. If they're reapplying for stuff, we can go to these documents and say, okay, is this still valid? Is this still valid? Instead of having to require them to bring in those documents again and again and again, and for different programs again and again and again. So somebody usually when somebody applies for cash assistance, they're also applying for food stamps and Medicaid at the same time. So that's a one-shot deal with that document. But food stamps in and of itself and without the cash assistance and Medicaid are two separate programs, really. But we've been able to facilitate the sharing of those documents across those programs so a person doesn't have to recreate or resubmit the same documents for the two separate programs. So it's made us more efficient, and it's allowed us to also expand on sharing with other agencies, and that's part of HHS Connect of what we're doing. We've also aligned ourselves with the state. We have the same solution in terms of document management, but with the State Office of Temporary Assistance, which is kind of our oversight, we are embarking on an exercise to share data, our images with them, so that even if a person goes to any of the other counties in New York State, if those documents are available, they can be used there. A lot of times you have people coming in and they have tragic situations. Maybe they're a victim of a fire or something like that. If we have those documents already, it's a tremendous help to be able to facilitate the whole process that they're going through.
So HRA is one of the largest administrators of food stamps, are now called SNAP, right, the SNAP program, in the country. Would you tell us more about the program and the various initiatives you've pursued to increase access to SNAP and how you've leveraged technology, outreach campaigns, and streamlining of processes in this effort?
Sure. I think that the food stamp program has really matured in the sense that it's really a support for lower income families that need to get the benefits that they should have to get the nutrition that they need. The food stamp program, I remember when I was a kid, I told you I was actually on assistance when I was a kid. I told you I was one of 12 and, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. And I remember, if you'll indulge me a minute, but I remember going to the government food pantry and, you know, loading up on, you know, 5 pound cans of peanut butter and blocks of cheese and, you know. And I actually remember one time, because we didn't have a car, I was traveling on the bus with my father, and there were some of my friends on the front of the bus. And the bus came to a stop, and one of the big cans of peanut butter rolled down the aisle. And my father said, "Richard, go get that." So I had to walk down there. Now, USDA government right on the can. And so my friends knew, and it was an embarrassment. The food stamp program isn't like that anymore. They're much more discreet, given technology, about how people make use of the technology through an EBT card. Exactly, Stu. So, you know, you don't know if somebody's swiping their credit card or swiping their EBT card, and nor should you know. But it has expanded, like I said, to service lower-income people. And so these are people who are working people. Technology has allowed us to expand the outreach to those people and meet them again on their terms. We have community-based organizations now that will accept applications, so they can do that when they know that those people are available or the people need to engage with them. So we've enabled a number of community-based organizations to submit a full application in. We've expanded our hours, as something Commissioner Doerr did in some of the sites, so that, you know, after hours, people can take advantage of our services after work. We've expanded the use of our interactive voice response system so that on food stamp recruitment, when people have to reapply or renew their eligibility, a lot of that can happen over the telephone now if it's applicable to them. So all of these things in technology allow the food stamp user, end user client, to deal with the things that they have to deal with to maintain their eligibility and get their benefits, but more on their schedule. And I think that technology has been a great enabler of that. And, you know, I don't think that the food stamp program would be as successful if it hadn't been that, because people would have to be taking off from work to meet their caseworker and stuff like that. So it really has been an enabler and a tremendous support in that regard, I think.
What does the future hold for information technology at the New York City Human Resources Administration? We will ask Richard Seymour, Deputy Commissioner and Chief Information Officer at HRA, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management in Government, an Introduction to Earned Value Management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine, and we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts in greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Richard Seymour, Deputy Commissioner and Chief Information Officer at the New York City Human Resources Administration. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Stuart Vinsky. Rich, we like to talk to our guests a lot about collaboration partnerships among agencies and private sector. How are you leveraging partnerships to improve IT operations and outcomes at HRA?
So we have, I would say, two different kinds of partners. We have partners both in the private sector and the public sector. Our partnership with the state is a pretty strong one. We're not always aligned on how we want to get things done, but we see the value in working together on things. So a very good example of that I talked about a little bit earlier was the document managing and document imaging. We have all of these images. If somebody goes to a different county, it makes a lot of sense that those images are available to that county to see and use in the processing of somebody's eligibility for benefits. Because of our work and our partnership with State Office of Temporary Disability Assistance, we will be able to do that. We are going to share our documents across both the upstate, which is all the other counties, and New York City. That's a great collaboration. Also, we collaborate with OTDA in terms of technology solutions. We establish standards. So we have a protocol, like I said, for communicating with the legacy system, the welfare management system. We've pushed the state, and the state has responded very well in terms of being able to openly communicate with that legacy system. So now that's the standard that's in place for everybody to communicate with that system. So those kinds of partnerships help tremendously, and I think that it makes us more efficient. It makes us more aware of the direction where people are going, and so it has some sort of influence on how we might proceed on things. From the private sector, we gain a lot with our partnerships. I think that I am both fair and open with our partners, our private sector partners, but I think I'm demanding. We give our private sector partners a lot of money, I think, and it's a lot of taxpayer money. And I think that they have to be responsible. Now, I will be responsible to them in terms of if they need to get something done. I appreciate when a vendor comes in and says, look, I'm trying to make my quarter here. Is there any way you can facilitate the processing of this procurement that you've already decided on and stuff like that? And to the extent that I can, I'll do that. I think that gains credibility and it gains good partnership with those vendors. But at the same time, I will demand of the vendors that when we're implementing something, that it's not something that they can just try and implement and walk away from. They have to be responsible to us in terms of being able to train us on new technology, being able to do proofs of concept a lot of times on their own dime, so that I can see and make a business case for the value of something. And our private sector vendors have been very responsive to that. I think that our private sector vendors, for the most part, get the city and get, especially in these economic times, I will challenge them to say, how can I reduce costs? Mm-hmm. And they'll come to me with real solutions, not just something that's going to pad their commission, but things that I think serve the city and help us meet what our goals are. So we leverage those both on the public and private sector, and I think it works for us.
So earlier in the conversation, you mentioned some of the challenges that HRA and your role in MIS face today. Looking forward, what are some of the major opportunities and challenges your organization will encounter in the future, and how do you envision your office will evolve to meet those challenges?
Well, more and more, we are becoming, people say it's a smaller world. The world is getting smaller, right? The direction that I think that we are really headed in terms of delivery of social services, is we're trying to break down these silos of what a client needs. And I think ultimately we will wind up as an organization, and this is Richard Seymour's opinion, but is that we will be able to engage a client because we'll have technology to share information and really have the vision of no wrong door when a person comes in. We will be able to engage a person and say, okay, what are your issues? What do you see as your problems? You're unemployed, or you're in between jobs, or you just got laid off and you need some temporary assistance here. But, hey, by the way, I also have an elderly parent that I'm being responsible for, and I have a child that needs child care and stuff like that. We'll be able, because of technology,